Welcome to the Opium Den. Today is May 1st, 2009, and we're going to conduct an interview with Chris Crane. He is the Executive Director of Students for Sensible Drug Policy, SSDP. It is a nationwide college-based organization that works to bring some common sense to our drug policy. Chris Crane has been the Executive Director since 2000, and Chris is a pretty bright fellow. He graduated magna cum laude from the American University. He has done lots of media interviews. He's done TV, radio, newspaper, and he's a very well-spoken young man with regards to drug policy. So we're going to spend some time with Chris. So I hope you enjoy this this interview, and we're going to give Chris a call here and get it started. So, Chris Crane, Executive Director of SSDP, inside the Opium Den. Okay, hope he's awake.
Hello?
Hello, Chris.
Hi, Dan.
Daniel Williams, how are you?
I'm doing terrific. How are you?
Well, pretty good. I want to thank you for coming inside the Opium Den this morning. I know you've been pretty busy with your agenda, and we just want to give our thanks for taking time to speak with us today.
Absolutely. I'm happy to be here, and thanks for having me on.
Well, great. I want to start out. We got a couple of questions here we want to get through, but I want to start off. I did some research on who you are, and you're a pretty bright fellow. I didn't realize that you had graduated magna cum laude from the American University, and I know you've been on TV a lot, but I was struck by one particular quote at the bottom of your bio. It said that, speaking of Chris Crane, of course, he is particularly good at saving the world. So you've got quite a burden, my friend. You've got quite a burden.
Well, so I didn't write that line. That was one of our staff members having a little bit of fun there. But I certainly appreciate the vote of confidence.
Well, I think you're a pretty bright young man. So I want to start off by just asking what's going on these days with SSDP? What's on the agenda and who you fighting?
Well, we are still organizing students. We've been expanding at an incredibly rapid rate, and we've now got chapters on over 150 college campuses across the United States. And we've got sister organizations that have opened in Canada and Great Britain and Australia, so we're actually starting to spread internationally. So things in that respect are going really well. We're expanding so rapidly at the chapter level that we're having to hire more staff members at the national office to really keep up with the number of new chapters in the system and their campaigns. One big thing we've got going on, we're planning for Cinco de Mayo, is an action that's going to be taking place on dozens of campuses around the country to really draw attention to the out-of-control violence in Mexico and along the border that's being spurred on by drug prohibition. Like I said, a number of our chapters on dozens of campuses around the country will be performing these actions on Cinco de Mayo. They're going to be lining up Mexican flags on their campuses to draw attention to this issue. We've created great flyers and handouts that they'll be using to help educate their college communities, their campus communities. And really, we hope to draw some light and draw some national media attention to the drug prohibition-fueled violence that's really wreaking havoc south of the border.
Well, those are all good endeavors. And speaking of south of the border, President Felipe Calderon is back in the news with his desires to decriminalize or legalize cannabis. A few years ago, they tried to, they had a bill ready to be signed, reducing penalties, or not reducing penalties, but apparently decriminalizing small possessions of all drugs. And this time, his reach isn't quite as broad. He's trying to do it just for cannabis. Do you think there's going to be much chance of that passing now that we have a slightly more tolerant president in the White House?
Do I think it's going to pass it in Mexico? Yes, I do. I mean, Calderon is, like you said, I think he's expressed some support for this, which is great because his predecessor, Vicente Fox, vetoed this bill the last time it was passed. So it looks, I mean, from everything that I'm hearing, It looks very likely to pass and be signed into law. And, you know, I think the last time, from all indications, are that Vicente Fox vetoed the bill because of strong pressure from the White House under the Bush administration. I don't think you're going to see that kind of pressure from the Obama administration. They seem to, at least on the international front, be much more tolerant of other countries taking their own approaches to drug issues without the kinds of threats and chest beating that we got from the Bush administration anytime another country decided to take a different direction. So I think it's going to pass, and I think it'll probably become law this year. And I think the Obama administration will probably stay quiet. I don't think they'll say anything positive or negative. They'll probably stay very quiet about it.
Well, I think the rallying cry among the stoner crowd will be goodbye Amsterdam, hello Mexico.
Well, I wouldn't get that far ahead of yourselves just yet. they're decriminalizing very small amounts of possession only, and there will be no coffee shops. There'll be no distribution channels. We're talking about something that we already have here in the United States in about 12 states. It's no different than basically the law in Ohio currently. Other than, I guess, in Ohio you can get a ticket, a civil ticket, whereas in Mexico there'll be no penalties. But it's not going to create any sort of distribution channels. There's going to be no legal ways to buy or anything like that. You'll only be able to possess a very small amount of marijuana, it's a few grams. Anybody looking for their marijuana vacation destination would probably still be wise to look across the Atlantic rather than south to Mexico.
Well, that's probably true. But do you believe that this type of a policy will kind of create a laissez-faire attitude towards marijuana? I mean, I understand that there won't be coffee shops and the like, but do you think that there'll be a considerably decreased emphasis on marijuana as a whole, which would make it a little bit easier?
To be perfectly honest, I don't think so. I think that there'll be a decreased emphasis on going after people for marijuana possession. But the stated reason, at least that we're hearing from the Mexican government for supporting this, is that it's going to free up police resources to go after traffickers and cartels and people who are moving larger amounts. So they're still going to be fighting the drug war and fighting the marijuana war. In Mexico, they're just going to be doing it at the dealer and trafficker level, and leaving the leaving the marijuana smokers alone. I don't see a real decreased emphasis. And unfortunately, while this will be very good for marijuana consumers in Mexico, it's not really going to do anything to curb the violence that's brought on by these cartels, because there's going to be no distribution channels in place, and they're still going to be fighting just as hard, if not harder, against the people who are dealing and trafficking in marijuana, which may only actually ramp up the violence, because the violence is going to get worse if the government tries to crack down even harder. The cartels are going to fight back even harder, so you may actually see an increase in violence after this passes if they do indeed spend more resources trying to fight the trafficking.
Well, Chris, what's your take on a lot of the recent mainstream media emphasis on the importance of the marijuana revenue to the cartels? Do you think that's pretty much on target, or do you think it's kind of overblown, the amount of revenue the cartels derive from marijuana?
No, I don't think it's overblown. They derive an incredible amount of revenue. Some of the statistics I've seen says it's something like 70% of the products that they traffic is marijuana. Now, that doesn't mean it's 70% of their profit, because the profit margin on marijuana is much lower than it is on cocaine, which is the other major drug that they're trafficking. But clearly, if this is 70% of the physical product that they're or over 70% of the physical product that they're trafficking, then clearly they're bringing in a lot of money on the marijuana trade. And I think that some of the mainstream media attention to the fact that if we were to tax and regulate and control marijuana here in the United States in a legal regulated system, you would cut off a major source of revenue to these cartels and put a lot of them out of business. So I think there's a lot to it.
Well, let's make the assumption that we do legalize and regulate marijuana here and put a dent in the cartels' revenue stream. My thinking, and of course it could be affected by my 40 years of smoking pot, but I'm thinking that if we were to legalize and regulate marijuana here and reduce the trafficker profits, couldn't that possibly lead to an increase in the violence as they try to recoup that revenue, that lost revenue through greater efforts of cocaine, methamphetamine, other narcotic distribution, basically panic to try to replace those revenues. Do you think that's a possibility?
It's a possibility, but I don't think that was what would wind up happening. Mainly because there's only so big of a market for cocaine. It's really not a very big market in the United States, and we are basically the biggest market for it. And really, it's a very small amount percentage of the population that uses cocaine.
But they're dedicated. They're dedicated.
They're dedicated, sure. But there's only a certain amount that they need to get into the country in order to meet demand. And if they if they start to sort of really ramp up their cocaine trafficking efforts, all they're going to do is drive the price down. Because they're going to drive supply up so high, and demand stays about the same. And demand for cocaine is not impacted by how much cocaine is on the market. So if they start, if they start really ramping up their efforts to traffic cocaine, or start trying to traffic more and more cocaine, all they're going to do is bring the price down and decrease their own revenue. So I don't see a major increase in violence as a result of legalizing marijuana in the United States as a very likely scenario. I think, in fact, it's more likely that we'll significantly cut down on their revenue and probably decrease the violence. Because they simply won't have the revenue to pay people to engage in these type of activities. They're not engaging in violence just because they like violence. They're doing it to protect their trade. If the trade doesn't exist, the violence doesn't exist.
Well, that's an interesting perspective. I tend to agree with parts of it. And speaking of agreeing and disagreeing with me, I'm still getting some blowback from a piece I had published on opposingviews.com. And my position was that medical marijuana, I don't believe that medical marijuana is the best strategy to move the drug debate forward. And I took a lot of heat from the commenters. There were a few that agreed with me, but the overwhelming majority of them thought that I was being callous and hard-hearted. And the piece very, very explicitly says that I believe medical marijuana is the efficacy of medical marijuana. I think it's a proven medicine for a lot of people, but I don't think it's the best strategy. And the reason I don't is that, in the past few years, as I've gotten more involved in drug policy reform, I was fortunate enough to talk to all the leaders, including you and Ethan and Alan and all the other fellows out there, Rob, and what they tell me in private is that most of them believe that the end game is to repeal drug prohibition across the board, but they don't believe the American public is ready to have a full-scale debate on repealing drug prohibition, and they feel that the medical marijuana is essentially their foot in the door. And My belief is that, okay, let's say that medical marijuana does become law of the land, and let's say that there's no distinction between medicinal and recreational use. If the end game is to repeal all prohibitions against drugs, what is the question that I've never been had answered to my satisfaction, and I don't think to the people I ask it either, is I say, okay, what drug will you champion next? Let's say you get marijuana done, and if the end game is to repeal prohibitions, what drug will you champion next? Will it be cocaine, LSD, MDMA? What? And to be very candid with you, I have not received a sufficient answer. So I want to ask you what do you think would be the next move by all of us in drug policy reform if we obtain the goal of creating a legal and regulated market for marijuana, whether it's medicinal or recreational? What do you think would be the next step?
Well, I think if we were to achieve a legal regulated market for marijuana, that's an interesting question. I'm not sure I really know the answer to that. I would like to think that the next step would be to have a very serious discussion about the way we deal with all drugs in this country and a real discussion about prohibition in general. And I would think that, you know, after a few years of marijuana regulation and legal marijuana in this country, and people see that, the sky hasn't fallen, and in fact it's actually, helped to decrease violence in inner cities and so forth. And I would imagine that within a few years, the benefits of a legal market would be very very apparent, and that might by itself lead to a discussion about prohibition in general. And that, while, people might have a harder time with the idea of ending prohibition for, cocaine or heroin or other drugs, methamphetamine and so forth, they might see that, hey, we did actually get rid of a lot of the sort of prohibition-related problems with marijuana, and it might make people a little bit more open to discussing, ending prohibitions as a whole and coming up with some other sort of regulatory system for other drugs. Now, I don't know if that regulatory system is going to look like, the sort of the alcohol model, which is probably what marijuana will wind up being under. But, I think people would be a lot more open to discussions of, I don't know, whether it would be pharmaceuticalization or some sort of licensing system, or there's a whole range of different options that have been proposed by a range of different people. But I do think that a legal regulated market would probably make people much more open to a discussion about, an entirely new paradigm and getting rid of prohibition as a whole.
Well, my thinking in that regard, you mentioned the reduction of violence, and I'm not really sure that regulating the sale and distribution of marijuana would really do that much to reduce violence. And that's kind of been my opinion for a while, and I found it to be backed up by Jeffrey Miron. I'm sure you're aware of this Harvard economist that in late March he wrote a pretty impressive article on how we should repeal prohibitions against all drugs. And his position was that it would be very unlikely that we would see a reduction in the overall violence if we did regulate and control marijuana. And there may be, because of the anticipation that people might have or the way it was sold to the people that were going to cut down on a lot of this violence, if that didn't come to fruition, there could be possibly a backlash against the cannabis legalization. And they may rethink the idea that, well, we didn't stop the violence per se with regulating cannabis. What makes you think we would do it if we regulate all of the other drugs? And it could create a backlash. What are your thoughts on that?
I think that's a very interesting perspective, and there may well be some validity to what you're saying. I do think we would see a real reduction in violence south of the border, because it would cut off a major source of revenue to the cartels, as we just discussed. So if we were talking about it in those terms, I think that may actually help solve that problem. But I don't think that when we're talking about legalizing marijuana, that we should really be focusing on reduction in violence. I don't think that's the best selling point. Certainly in these tough economic times, focusing more on the economic benefits of taxing and regulating marijuana is probably a much better strategy, and something that, once it were actually happened, people would see real benefits. I think you do raise a good point. There isn't a whole lot of street violence associated with just marijuana, although there certainly is some. I think we need to be very careful about the arguments that we use promote taxing and regulating marijuana. And then if we're just focusing on reducing violence, then we may be setting ourselves up for a backlash. But as you well know, there are dozens of other very good and very compelling reasons for establishing a legal regulated marijuana market. If we really focus on those, and we make it clear that there are a whole number of benefits to regulating marijuana that people will see when it actually happens, I think we'll be fairly safe from a backlash.
Well, when I speak on college campuses about drugs and drug prohibition and repealing drug prohibition, I tend to caution my listeners about taking too much or putting too much stock in how much money revenue could be raised from legalizing and controlling the sale of marijuana. they say that, you know, it's like a $50 billion a year business in the United States. And Joe Klein wrote recently, I think it was in Time or Newsweek, that it was such a huge market that if we tax that $50 billion, we're going to provide, you know, $10 to $12 billion a year in revenue. But what I think he failed to take into account is that $50 billion market, there's a tremendous prohibition price put into that. And if we regulated and controlled the market, that $50 billion market may be reduced to 15 or 20 billion, and then a 10%.
You're absolutely right on that. In fact, I gave a speech yesterday at Yale University, and this very topic came up. I think you're raising a very valid point here, the current estimates for marijuana's worth, and the value of the marijuana market is tremendously inflated. Marijuana prohibition has led to a weed that is naturally occurring on every continent on the planet, minus Antarctica, being literally worth more than its weight in worth more than its weight in gold. Literally, an ounce of good quality marijuana is worth more than an ounce of gold. That is purely a product of prohibition driving the price way up. So I think some of these estimates may actually be a little bit high.
Yeah.
When we talk about how much revenue we can raise from legal market. However, there still would be a significant amount of revenue raised. I think that the taxes would, you know, just knowing the way that we tax, particularly products like alcohol or tobacco or so forth, that the taxes on it would probably be very high, as they are with other intoxicants, illegal intoxicants. We would still bring in a disproportionate amount of tax revenue on marijuana compared to other legal regulated products, just because we tend to do that with intoxicants. So we can't discount how much money we would raise on taxes. That would probably, you know, just the taxes alone would probably keep the prices artificially inflated.
Right, but there's also the advantage or the it wouldn't be a revenue per se, but it would be a shifting of resources. We would no longer spend $6 to $10 billion a year chasing down all of us stoners. So I think there's probably more money on that side of the table than there is on the tax revenue side.
You actually took the words right out of my mouth. That was exactly the next point I was going to make. Was that, you know, we're not only talking about tax revenue here. We're also talking about tremendous amounts of money being saved on law enforcement costs. Particularly law enforcement costs and prison costs and the cost of prosecuting all these cases. And now we're talking about a very significant amount of money when we're talking about the savings that we would have in addition to the to potential tax revenue. And that really can't be discounted. I mean, we spend an inordinate amount of money, on law enforcement resources tracking down, you know, people for marijuana offenses, the drug offenses. All that police time costs a lot of money. The time spent prosecuting these cases costs a lot of money. Imprisoning somebody for a drug offense costs, over $40,000 a year per person. So we're talking about an incredible amount of savings. Just in money that we'll no longer have to be spending, even if the price of marijuana is so artificially inflated that it's brought down quite a bit in a legal regulated market, we'll still be saving a whole lot of money.
Yeah, and as you regarding prices, I've heard of some fellows that grow extremely potent hydroponic weed. And this stuff goes. This stuff sells for $5,000 to $6,000 a pound. And when I speak to my friends in Amsterdam and the like, they tell me that a pound of high grade hydroponic, make your eyes roll back in your head type of pot can actually, once you amortize some of your startup costs, can actually be grown for about $400 to $500 a pound. So if you look at that, the $50 billion to the $500, that's a reduction of like 90% in the actual market valuations. But given that to be true, what do you think that we would be driven, the average consumer of cannabis, do you think we would be driven to grow our own if the taxes were too onerous, or we would just be happy to pay whatever knowing that we could go and buy it without consequence?
Honestly, there's really no, I can't really point to any evidence either way, so I can only go on, you know, my own observations and, a sort of educated guesses here, but my guess is that the majority of people would buy it from legal sources and probably wouldn't grow their own, but certainly some people would decide to grow their own because it would be a lot cheaper that way. Many people would do that, but I would think that the vast majority of people would probably just go and buy it from a legal source. I don't think it has very much to do with taxes or prices. I think that, that may cause some people to grow their own, absolutely. But I think it just more has to do with convenience.
Exactly.
Growing good quality marijuana takes time and takes effort. And most people don't have the time. They don't have the time to do that.
They're stoners, Chris. We're laying on the couch all day, if you believe the ONDCP.
I don't like to exacerbate these stereotypes. They're people. Most people are lazy. Either lazy or they're busy, I should say. Not most people are lazy. Most people are either lazy or busy, one or the other. And either way, if you're lazy or if you're busy, you're not going to take the time to grow really high-quality marijuana. Because you have to learn grow techniques. You have to obviously invest some of your own money in the equipment needed to especially grow hydroponically. It takes a lot of time. It takes a lot of effort, and most people would rather just be able to go down to the corner store and buy their marijuana that way. It's certainly analogous to beer or wine, and particularly beer.
Exactly.
It's not that hard to make your own beer, brew your own beer. You can do it with an upfront investment for the equipment and materials. You can brew your own beer, but you've got to learn how to do, if you want to brew really good beer, you've got to put some effort into it to learn how to do it right. Same thing, it's fairly easy to grow marijuana, but if you want to grow good marijuana, it takes some effort. But very few people actually brew their own beer because it's time consuming, and they're either, too lazy or too busy to do it. And they would much rather just go down to the corner store and buy a six pack. Much more convenient for them. I think you probably see the same thing with the illegal marijuana market. Whether or not the taxes were extremely high, it's simply a convenience and time factor for people.
I agree. So give me and anybody who'll be listening to this when we put it in the archives, give me what you think would be. How do you think a regulated market would look? I mean, give me the nuts and bolts and the infrastructure of how you would envision a legal and controlled market for cannabis.
Honestly, I think it would look very similar to our alcohol model. I think it would vary state to state. Right now for alcohol, states, the different states deal with it differently. In some states, you can only buy from the government. And I believe in Pennsylvania, you can only buy from government-run stores. The government's the only entity allowed to sell alcohol. In other states, you have to go to government-approved stores, like package stores or ABC stores. Many states, you can buy alcohol in any supermarket or bodega, grocery store, liquor store, whatever.
Drive-through, you can buy them in drive-throughs. I mean, how fucking crazy is that?
Yeah, exactly. It's like you can literally have to do drive-through liquor stores, which seems to be a disaster waiting to happen. I think it would be up to the local standards and the states would decide how they want to regulate it. But I think the model is the alcohol model. There would almost certainly be age controls. I would hope that they would probably be 18 rather than 21, but realistically, it would probably be 21 since that's what it is for alcohol.
I'm going to interrupt you. That's a good point. I think 18 is a pretty good age. I think 21 is artificial, and you go to college when you're 18. You go to war when you're 18. I think 18 is probably is the correct age for access. I didn't mean to interrupt you, but I you made a great point there. Not that many people talk about 18. They talk about 21 or even 25. Let's let them get a little more mature before they smoke this shit. I'm encouraged that you say 18. I'm encouraged.
We actually at SCP, we've actually taken an official position on the drinking age. We support lowering the drinking age from 21 to 18. It's not something that we actively work on, but we have signed on as a supporter to the Amethyst Initiative, which is looking to reduce the drinking age from 21 to 18. So we do support an 18-year-old drinking age. We would support an 18-year-old age limit for a legal marijuana market. But we also recognize the reality of the situation is that if alcohol still has a 21-year-old age limit and we set up a legal marijuana market, it's almost certainly going to be 21 as well. So just talking practicality and reality here, it would probably be a 21-year-old age limit. But, you know, aside from that, I think there would be very similar controls and regulations on marijuana that we would that we have on alcohol. So you'd have an age limit. You'd have a prohibition on driving under the influence. You know, you wouldn't be able to smoke and go to, you know, go to work if you're found under the influence at work. That would probably be able to be punished for that, just like you'd be punished if you can, you know, if you go to work drunk. If you, I think there, you know, there'd be other, all sorts of other zoning restrictions. I mean, you know, and a lot of, you can't right now walk through the streets with an open container and drink alcohol on the street. You probably wouldn't be allowed to, you know, walk down the street and smoke a joint in public. It'd probably be confined to your home or to, you know, marijuana bars, coffee shops, whatever they would be called, or certain designated areas, just like we have for alcohol. You would probably zone where you can and cannot sell it, just like we zone for alcohol. You can't just, you know, I couldn't just open a bar in my house if I wanted to, because I don't live in a commercial zone. I live in a residential district, and I couldn't sell alcohol out of my home if I wanted to. I wouldn't be allowed to open up a marijuana store in my home if I wanted to, because it wouldn't be a zoned area for commerce. So I think for marijuana, it would look very similar to alcohol, and it would differ state to state based on, you know, the state and community standards.
Well, I think you're on the right track there. I want to talk about transactional quantities. When I visit Amsterdam, and I don't get there enough, but I get there frequently, you go to the coffee shops and you buy like 2 or 3 grams of hashish or marijuana. Over here, you know, we buy in larger quantities because we're not sure if we're going to be able to get it when we run out. So do you think that the transactional quantities of cannabis over here would mirror what we're seeing in Amsterdam? Because if you can just buy 2 or 3 days supply, knowing that when you run out, you can go replenish, do you think our transactional quantities will be smaller? And how would you apply the tax if they say there's going to be a $50 tax or $100 tax per ounce? Do you think that would break down, obviously, into the smaller purchasing of grams? How do you look at that?
That's a really interesting question. Well, I think it's a little bit difficult to really compare to the Netherlands, because the reason that the transaction levels in the Netherlands are so much lower is not because it's not only because you know, people don't feel like they have to buy a larger amount, or they don't know when they're going to get it, although there's certainly some truth to that. But in the Netherlands, they don't allow sales of anything over 5 grams. That's part of the regulatory scheme that they've worked out. The coffee shop can't sell you more than 5 grams.
Would you think that makes sense for if we were to enact a regulated policy, or do you think that would be part and parcel? You know, you can't buy more than 5 grams at a time.
No, I don't think that makes sense at all. It's the only reason they do it that way in the Netherlands is because it's technically still illegal to sell marijuana, and so
right.
They just tolerate sales of small amounts. That this way they can say that they're still in compliance with UN anti-drug treaties. It's a really sort of convoluted, strange way of going about it. But that's the reason for it. It doesn't really have anything to do with reducing the amount that people buy. Because you could go to one coffee shop, buy 5 grams. You can go to, you know, you could hop around and go to 20 coffee shops and buy 5 grams of 20 coffee shops of 100 grams and bring it all home with you. You're just not allowed to sell more than 5 grams to any one person at a time.
Well, let me speak hypothetically. Let's say that Chris Crane is a cannabis connoisseur. Would you buy in small quantities, knowing that you could buy a different flavor, a different type in a few days, or would you buy like an eighth of an ounce or a half ounce and smoke it until you ran out? Using you as a hypothetical.
Honestly, probably something in between, which is, you know, similar to what we see with booze. You know, we're talking about like a wine connoisseur, for example. You know, wine connoisseurs will often, you know, they'll buy a bottle of wine. They'll, you know, see if they like it. They'll buy, you know, they'll often go to the store and they'll buy, you know, maybe 7 or 8 bottles of different kinds of wine.
Yeah, but that shit gets better with age if you lay it down. I'm not so sure that marijuana is going to have an aging process.
that's a very good point. So people might buy smaller quantities of marijuana just because it's right. It does lose some of its potency when it's been sitting around for a while. So you might see people want to buy in small quantities, but some people might just want to have a lot around them. Some people don't want to have to go to the store every other day or every day. They might want to buy a larger amount, so they only have to buy it every week or two. I think it would really vary. I mean, there are people who want to buy their bottles of wine every day, or they want to buy, you know, some people buy a six-pack a day, or some people like to buy, you know, a couple cases and hang on to them, and then they don't have to buy another one for another week. Or some people will buy a case of wine and hang on to it, and then they'll buy another case when it's over. Or if they find a kind of wine that they really like, they'll go out and they'll buy a case of it, and they'll hang on to that for a while. So I don't think we should be limiting the amount that one person can buy for their own consumption, especially if we've eliminated the black market. There's no worry that they're going to like go and buy a whole lot of it and then go resell it.
Yeah,
I don't worry about that with people buying.
Yeah, I don't think we should limit the ability to go from store to store and buy a few grams at a time. I'm just thinking that would be probably more the profile than the guy who buys a couple cases of beer just so he doesn't have to drive drunk to the store every day and buy his resupply. But
I think you're going to see a wide variety. I mean, I think the majority of people would buy smaller amounts, just like the majority of people buy smaller amounts of alcohol. Most people, when they go to the store, they buy a six pack, and then the next time they want to drink, they go and they buy another six pack. When you don't have to worry about where your next supply is going to come from. You don't have to worry about, is my dealer going to be around, and next week, or, where am I going to get it? Because, we have an unregulated supply of marijuana right now in a criminal black market. So people are much more inclined to buy larger amounts,
right,
knowing that, I'm going to have it for, I'll have this for a few weeks or for a month. I think if you know that you can get it anytime you want it, people are going to be less likely to spend, larger amounts of money to buy larger quantities of it, especially since it does lose potency as it sits around. Most people would probably buy smaller amounts, just like most people buy, buy smaller amounts with alcohol.
Yeah, you're right.
But it would depend on a whole number of factors. I just don't think that we should, really limit what people could buy for their own consumption. But I think that naturally people are going to buy smaller amounts. Here's like a thing: naturally people are going to actually gravitate towards lower potency marijuana.
Well, that was my next question. You think they'll gravitate towards lower potency, or do you think it's virtually impossible to buy shitty cannabis in Amsterdam. Do you think people will gravitate towards the lower end, or you think it'll mimic the alcohol thing? I mean, a guy that drinks cheap scotch dreams about drinking, 30-year-old single malt. Do you think that because the cost differential will be so slight between, ragweed and good weed, that the potency and the consumption will gravitate towards the better weed?
Well, I don't think we would see much like ditch weed or swag or whatever you want to call it. But you'd see a variety in a decent marijuana from lower potency good marijuana to high potency good marijuana. I think you'd get rid of all the sticks and seeds and brown nasty stuff that makes up the lower end of the market now. So I think the lower end of the market in a legal market would look very different than the low end of the market does right now.
Yeah.
But I think people generally do tend to sort of gravitate towards lower potency intoxicants in general. And if you look at the alcohol
market,
you're
right. That's a very strong point. Very good point.
Yeah,
but I'm gonna let you make it.
Go ahead. Just about everywhere in the world, beer and wine are by far the most highly consumed forms of alcohol. People buy way more beer, consume way more beer, way more wine than they do scotch or vodka or harder liquor, Everclear or something like that.
Do you think if somebody that likes to drink, 4 to 6 beers a night, and get a nice little buzz on, do you think if they had the opportunity to drink just one beer to get the same effect as 4 or 6, they would do that? Or is the social aspect of drinking going to restrict that to a degree, and they'll still drink 4 or 5 beers because there's the social lubricant, the social aspect of it? Or, like I said, do you think they would drink one beer to get the buzz?
I don't think that they would. I mean, in fact, right now there are lots of beers that are 9-10% alcohol, and they don't do very well. They're specialty beers for the most part.
Are they more expensive?
They tend to be more expensive, but they've got 3 times the alcohol content and cost 1.5 times the price, or 2 times the price, it's actually a better deal. And yet most people don't want those beers. They like the lower potency beers. They like taste better the lower potency beers. I think they'd like they like the social aspect of it. But also just somebody who sits at home and drinks. They'd like to be able to drink, 3 or 4 beers over the course of the evening, just because they actually enjoy the process of drinking beer. They enjoy the taste of beer. And so they might want us to sit and drink you know, sit and drink three or four beers over the course of the day, over the course of the evening, and get a little buzz. Whereas if they were to drink three or four of these 9% beers over the course of the evening, they'd be drunk, and that's not what they're looking for. So there certainly would be people who would buy, you know, the lower potency good marijuana, who might want to smoke, you know, two or three bowls a night just because they actually like the act of sitting and smoking a bowl or smoking a joint. You know, they wouldn't want the highest potency marijuana where, you know, they would take a couple hits and then they're good for the night. You know, some people would. I mean, particularly people who are concerned about, you know, their lungs, if they're smoking and not vaporizing, you know, would probably prefer, you know, higher potency marijuana because they're ingesting less burnt carbon material into their lungs.
I'm very concerned about my lungs in that regard.
and it's a real concern. I think, thankfully, you know, we know a lot now about vaporization and vaporizing technology that can really mitigate the harms associated with inhaling any burnt material.
And let's not forget about edibles. Edibles are a rising star, in my opinion. I see a lot more reference to edibles.
There's issues to edibles that don't exist with smoking or vaporization, in that there's actually, and I'm not an expert at this, but I do know that there's a chemical process that happens when an edible is broken down in your liver. That creates some sort of THC byproduct, the second form of THC, which is why you actually can get like too high off of eating. When you eat too much marijuana, it can be a very sort of uncomfortable feeling. Whereas if you smoke too much marijuana, you tend to just
pass out.
You don't get any higher. You just get a little tired. There's issues to edibles in that it's much harder to control your dosage. Because it kicks in, you know, an hour after you eat it, as opposed to, you know, smoking, where it kicks in, you know, a minute or two later, and you actually can eat too much, and it can be an uncomfortable, feeling for people. So, but that is certainly a way. I mean, if you're really concerned about inhaling anything, that is definitely a way to mitigate it. And if you're baking your own, and you know what you're using, and you know how potent your baked goods are. Or in a legal market, if you're, you know, buying the same baked goods from the same, you know, the same company every day, you know exactly what's in it. You know exactly how high they're going to get you. You can regulate that fairly effectively. So it's certainly, you know, baked goods are a good way if you have a really secure source of mitigating any, you know, harms to your lungs. But if you like, you know, if you prefer the, you know, smoking aspect of it, I would definitely recommend vaporization over smoking, because it gets rid of basically all of the negative side effects of inhaling burnt carbon material in your lungs.
Right. Well, I want to move back to the field of drug policy. I mean, I really enjoy talking a bit about marijuana, and you raised some good points. But let's get back to a little more sober aspect of drug policy. In my in that Opposing View article that I wrote, a number of the respondents said that, you know, I should quit rocking the boat, and I should understand that Obama can't come out and make these type of pronouncements, which I disagree with. But they also said, listen, don't rock the boat. Jim Webb, the senator from Virginia, he is Barack Obama's Trojan horse on this. So I would like to talk about the Webb proposal, the National Criminal Justice Commission Act of 2009, and I'd like to get your take on it, and what value you see there, or cautions that you see there.
Oh, I think this is a huge development, probably the biggest since I've been involved in drug policy for the last 11 years or so. For those not familiar with it, and Jim Webb has introduced legislation in the Senate, he's already got close to 30 co-sponsors, and he expects to have 60 co-sponsors before it even moves. So it's almost certainly going to pass. They're still looking for the House for a House version of the bill. But what it would call for is a blue ribbon commission appointed. The chief of it would be appointed by the president. It would be a bipartisan commission made up of experts in the field to take a serious look at reforming our criminal justice system as a whole. It's not just about drug policy. It's about a complete overhaul of the criminal justice system, making the criminal justice system more just and more fair. And its stated goal, and the reason that Webb is so big on this, is to significantly reduce the prison population, because the prison population is so out of control, and there's so many people incarcerated for nonviolent offenses, and we simply, especially in these economic times, we simply can't afford to continue doing what we've been doing. As far as our prison system is concerned, our criminal justice system is concerned. And Jim Webb is somebody that we know gets it. He absolutely gets this issue. He gets it on drug policy. He gets in on criminal justice reform, and this has been his number one issue since he was elected to the Senate in 2006. He's been holding hearings for the last 2 years in the Senate, and private hearings as well, from a whole number of experts from both sides of the issue. But he's certainly heard from many people on the reform side of things, in drug policy and criminal justice reform. He's really taken all sides into account when calling for the creation of this commission. That's the background of it. So we're starting off from a really, really good place, way better than we ever have. And now we're talking about a very serious commission made up of experts who are going to look at this issue for 18 months. Now, any serious-minded commission that's going to look at the criminal justice system through the lens of how do we seriously reduce our prison population, any serious commission that looks at it through that lens is going to come back with very serious recommendations for drug policy reform. There's no way that they can look at that and come up with anything other than recommendations to eliminate mandatory minimum sentencing, because that is the number one reason for the massive prison expansion in this country over the last 25 years. There's no way that they can look at this and not recommend eliminating mandatory minimum sentencing or significantly reducing mandatory minimum sentencing. There's no way they can look at this and not recommend treatment over incarceration for nonviolent drug offenders. So I really think that if this happens, we're going to see some very serious recommendations for very serious reform measures that are going to have a very real impact on drug policy, on our nation's drug policy. Now, it's not going to end up calling for legalizing all drugs. I doubt that. It's possible that it might call for legalizing marijuana, and Jim Levitt said as much himself. But it certainly would call for really serious reform in the criminal justice system, and in particular, drug policy, which is at the heart of prison expansion. So I think this is a tremendous opportunity. It gives us a chance to really cloak this issue under broader criminal justice reform, which is much more palatable to politicians and the general public than just drug policy reform. So I think it's a tremendous opportunity, and I really see some serious reform coming out of it.
Well, I'm a lot older than you. I'll be 59 next month, and I've been paying attention to politics since I was 17 years old and Richard Nixon came onto the scene, and I've seen a number of high-level blue-ribbon commissions, not just on drug policy, but commissions that are set up to make recommendations, and I see them ignored or implemented poorly or just not implemented at all. But one of the problems I have with Jim Webb's commission proposal is that it's an 18-month study, and it's probably going to take a couple of months for it to clear all the legislative hurdles and be set up. So then we have 18 months of work, and then you're going to have the discussions following. The commission disbands 60 days after they make their report, but there'll probably be a national debate of a few months. So what I'm seeing here is that we're going to have, by the time this thing gets done and recommendations are made, we're looking at probably 2 years, and from my perspective, that's going to put another 1.5 million people, mostly young people, into the criminal justice system just for the simple possession of marijuana. I'm wondering if Jim Webb is speaking with Rahm Emanuel or directly to President Obama on this. Wouldn't it make sense, if that's his advocacy and his core belief, wouldn't it make sense at the onset of this to do something about the simple possession of marijuana rather than wait another 2 years and see another 1.5 million kids go into the criminal justice system? Wouldn't that be an article of good faith?
Ideally, yes, but at the same time, it wouldn't pass right away. I mean, just look at the political realities. There's no way it would get through Congress within the next 2 years. And in doing that, Jim Webb would probably reduce the effectiveness of any recommendations that the commission comes out with 2 years from now, because now he'll be seen as, well, he's just another legalizer. And right now, Jim Webb is as credible as they come on this issue, being a former, Reagan's former Navy secretary, the former Republican, he's a law and order guy. So if he were to come out now and say, we need to just legalize marijuana while we're waiting for this commission to come out, it wouldn't pass.
Legalize it, but can't they take marijuana out of Schedule One very simply? Can't that be legislatively or even stroke of a pen?
They would have to pass through Congress. It's very difficult to do. But if they had a
with the Congress we have now, you think that would be difficult to do?
Absolutely. Yeah, there are a lot of conservative Democrats out there who don't want to touch this at all. The Democratic leadership does not want to touch this issue right now. They don't want to do anything that's going to make them seem too liberal. But if they've got this, it's true. But if they've got this major bipartisan commission, that gives them the political cover to do it, and that gives the Obama administration the political cover to support it.
What do you think is in Obama's back pocket or in the deep recesses of his mind on this issue? I can't believe that a guy who smoked pot and snorted cocaine became president. Obviously, he understands that didn't impede his ability to succeed. What do you think is? I mean, he's got a lot of political capital, and he's a great orator. Two questions. What do you think he's actually thinking? And the second question is, why doesn't he be a little more public and direct the conversation? He doesn't seem to have any problems dealing with, Gitmo and things of that nature. Why can't he just put a little, little bug in the air and get this going? So what do you think his thoughts are, and why isn't he doing something to help Jim Webb?
Good question. Well, he is. He's supportive of this commission. The administration supports this idea. I think it's hard to speculate into this or the deep recesses of somebody's mind. But going on Obama's record prior to running for president, he was very good on this issue. He supported decriminalization for years and sort of changed his stance when he decided to run for president. He had said just a few years ago that the war on drugs is an abject failure. So I think that he gets it. And he actually had worked on mandatory minimum sentencing reform as a state senator in Illinois. That was a big issue for him. And they got sentencing reform passed as an issue that he had championed in the Illinois Senate. I think that he gets this issue very well. I don't think he's willing to expend the political capital on it just yet. Because there's so many other issues that he's trying to deal with right now. And I think he's also an incredibly smart politician and recognizes that if he comes out and does something on this right away, that it's not likely to pass and it's likely to lose him political capital. So I think he wants to see something like a Jim Webb commission, like the Jim Webb commission, which would be bipartisan in nature, and would wind up with many of the recommendations that he would support. I think he'd like to see something like this happen to give him the political cover to push for the type of reforms that he'd like to see.
So you think he'd be comfortable? I mean, obviously he knows this fact. How comfortable do you think he is with the knowledge of the fact that this two-year time frame is going to put another 1.5 million people into the criminal justice system? How do you think he balances
that? I think he's probably uncomfortable with that. And again, I can't put words into his mouth.
No.
But he's probably uncomfortable with that. Fast as we all are, but I think he's a very smart politician. And he recognizes the political realities that there's really it would be almost impossible to prevent that from happening. Even if he came out now and said we need to move marijuana out of Schedule One, it probably wouldn't happen unless there was some sort of bipartisan support behind it, which right now there isn't. I think he probably thinks it's a tragedy that, another 1.5 million young people are going to get caught up in the system, but recognizes the political reality that there's no way that that's going to change without a commission like this or something like this.
He can accept it as collateral damage.
Well, it's not necessarily accepting the collateral damage. It's a recognition of, okay, I can push for this now and it'll fail. And then 2 years from now, I won't be able to get it done because we won't be credible on this anymore. Or I can keep quiet for now and wait 2 years and hopefully actually get it done in 2 years.
Okay, let's move.
Do you want the moral victory now of him saying of him coming out in favor of it, but not being able to do anything and potentially hindering progress 2 years down the line, or do we want him to stay quiet for a little while? And do it and push for it when he's actually got the political cover and the political backing to do it, then there's a real chance that it might pass. It's a political decision, and I think it's probably a smart one, unfortunately. As tragic as it is that all these people are going to get caught up in the system, and this is what I work for every day, is to prevent this from happening. But the ultimate goal is to stop this from happening, and I'd rather it be done in a way that is realistic than to get the moral victory of, you know, the president saying, I support this, when which may actually make our prospects of real reform worse in the long term. So I think it's a political calculation, it's a political decision, and it's probably the right one.
Well, let's move across the aisle, so to speak. In my book that I wrote, I suggested that it would be the Republicans more so than the Democrats who could make this, who could make the repeal of drug prohibition a reality. Looking at the devastation across the Republican playing field, and with Ron Paul being a good Republican voice on drug policy, do you think it would be smart, it would be wise for the Republicans in this reformulation of themselves to take this issue, take it away from the Obama administration and support repealing drug prohibition to grow their party and to get some of their basic core beliefs back on track? Well, what do you think about the Republicans doing something?
I would love to see it. I would absolutely love to see it.
Do you work with them as much as you work with the Democrats? Or, I mean, do you just work with anybody, or are you focused more on the Democrats and leaving the Republicans out of it, or how do you look at
that? We work with anybody. I mean, we're a nonpartisan organization. We work with Democrats. We work with Republicans. Gary Johnson, the former Republican governor of New Mexico, is a member of our board of directors. We'll work with whoever wants to work with us. I mean, unfortunately, the political reality has been that the Democrats have been much more supportive, although they've also sort of stabbed us in the back at times.
Joe Biden created the term drug czar, so yeah, the Democrats, I think,
Joe Biden has been as bad as they get on drug policy throughout the years. The Democrats are certainly they certainly have had their share of negative policies.
Yeah, there are no virgins out there on this from either side of the aisle. But I just wondered if you thought the Republicans could seize this issue and actually make something. I mean, 76% in a recent poll, 76% of the American adults believe that the drug war is failing. And granted, there are a number of them who believe we're not trying hard enough, but the overwhelming majority are ready for a fundamental change, and even many of those believe that repealing prohibition is a good idea. So I'm not so sure I buy this idea that's put out there that, you know, there's no political cover, there's no consensus, there's no desire in the general population for this type of deal. So,
well, I'm not saying there's no desire in the general population. I don't think that's been demonstrated well enough to politicians. The public is always ahead of politicians on issues like this. Even with something like medical marijuana, which has enjoyed over 70% support in all polling that's been done on the issue, it took passing medical marijuana initiatives in about 8 states before any state legislatures would seriously consider this. So there's no doubt the public is way ahead of the politicians on this, but we need to find ways that we can prove to politicians that this is not an issue that's going to hurt them politically, and if anything, it can help them politically.
Well, that's what I'm saying. Do you think the Republicans should take this banner and steal some thunder and grow their ranks and be more inclusive? Because Obama did a good job with young people in 2008, but when you look at the statistics, it was less than a 2% real increase there. So there's still a tremendous amount of voters out there who don't participate in it, and the overwhelming majority of them are young, and Ron Paul demonstrated that he could raise money based upon the issue of the drug war and his foreign policy initiatives. He got a little, off the reservation in other parts, but a lot of the young people I spoke with gave money to Ron Paul because they liked his war policy as far as Iraq, Afghanistan, and bringing troops home from the rest of the world, and his drug policy. Why can't the Republicans, or why don't you think the Republicans would seize this issue to right their ship, so to speak?
I hope that they do. I really hope that they do see this. The Republican Party right now is in a real state of flux, and they're suffering from a major identity crisis. And there seems to be two major wings of the Republican Party that are sort of fighting for control of the party, for what's going to be the heart of the party moving forward. And it seems like you've got the moralist Republicans, the Christian conservatives, so to speak, that wing of the party led by people like Sarah Palin, Mike Huckabee, these types of Republicans, and then you've got the more libertarian leaning business type Republicans, Ron Paul would be sort of the most extreme example of this, but even something like the Romney or something that, you know, they don't seem to really be that jazzed up by the social issues, but more so by more sort of libertarian-leaning philosophy. If that faction of the Republican Party winds up winning out, and I think it might take a while, but if that faction winds up winning out, I think there is a real chance that they actually might wind up championing this issue, because if they are going to move in a more libertarian direction, and I think eventually they're going to have to, because they're losing on social issues. They're losing big time on these social issues, and I think they may go through a period here where they sort of move further and further to the right, particularly in the social issue type of stuff, and they're going to continue to get killed in elections, and they're going to need to remake themselves. I think eventually the Republican Party is probably going to do what the Conservative Party is doing right now in Great Britain, which is they're moving away from these social issues towards a more sort of being a more moderate party with more sort of libertarian-leaning philosophy. And if our Republican Party, you know, in 2 years or 4 years or 8 years from now, you know, realizes that that's the only way that they're gonna that they're gonna become a majority party again, is by becoming more moderate on these social issues and more sort of libertarian leaning in general, then I think there's a real chance that they would stick up to the mantle of drug policy reform. But they're very far from being there.
Well, Chris, I know you've got another commitment coming up this morning, and I want to finish off here first by thanking you for joining us inside the Opium Den. It's been a very interesting, stimulating conversation. And I know you're a political junkie across the board. Obviously, you have your focus on drug policy, but I know you're a political junkie. And I just read this morning that Justice Souter may be retiring, which will give President Obama his first chance.
Yes, he announced his retirement this morning. Yeah.
Yeah. What do you think about that? I'm going to end up with your overall political junkiness here.
Sure. Well, it's interesting. I mean, it's not going to really shift the balance of the court very much, because he's one of the so-called liberal justices. So he's going to be replaced by somebody else who's going to almost certainly join the liberal wing of the court. And so we're going to, you know, wind up with four liberals, four conservatives, and Justice Kennedy, who's a sort of conservative-leaning moderate. So I don't think it's actually going to have that much of an impact on the court, although I do think there's a chance that Obama's going to wind up appointing somebody who's more liberal than Souter. Because if you remember, Souter was appointed by George H.W. Bush. Right, and he wound up turning into a...
He got snookered, didn't he? Bush got snookered.
He did. He wound up changing his philosophy and became more of a sort of a judicial philosophical liberal. But he is still of the liberal wing of the Supreme Court. He is still the most conservative of the liberal wing. He's definitely the most likely to break with the liberal wing and vote with the conservatives. And we've certainly seen that over the last couple of years, more than we had in years past. So if this is going to do anything, it's likely to sort of solidify the liberal wing of the court as even a little bit more liberal than it was, but just a little bit.
Is it going to be a woman?
I think it's very likely. I'll put it this way. I think it would be very unlikely that he'll pick a white man. It's really either going to be a woman or an African-American or a Latino. And I wouldn't put it past Obama to appoint the first ever Latino justice to the Supreme Court, which, you know, number one, that it's the fastest growing segment of the United States population. So it would only be fair and right to appoint a Latino justice. And also Obama, like I mentioned earlier, is a very smart politician and recognizes that Latinos are the fastest growing voter bloc in the country. He did an extremely good job of reaching out to Latinos and bringing them into the Democratic fold in 2008. They were, you know, relatively split in 2004 between Bush and Kerry. He changed that in 2008 and sort of brought a lot of Latinos into the Democratic camp. And appointing a Latino Supreme Court justice would probably even further solidify Latinos as a reliable Democratic voting bloc. I wouldn't be surprised at all if we see a Latino or a Latina, which would sort of satisfy putting another woman on the court and appointing the first Latino justice to the Supreme Court. If there is a well qualified female of Latin American descent, I think that would be a very wise political choice. for Obama, I wouldn't be surprised at all if that's what we wind up seeing. But I would be the only thing that would surprise me is if it's a white guy. I'll put it that way.
Okay. Well, Chris Crane, the executive director of Students for Sensible Drug Policy, we want to thank you for coming inside the Opium Den and airing out some of your views. We spoke here for a little over an hour, and I think everybody's going to be very interested in hearing this. So again, Chris Crane, Students for Sensible Drug Policy executive director and very bright guy. Thanks a lot.
Thank you so much for having me on. And just, give a final plug if anyone's interested in checking out our work at SSDP. Our website is schoolsnotprisons.com. Check it out if you're interested, especially if there's any college students listening who want to get involved in the efforts to end the war on drugs. Check out our website, contact us, and we will provide you all the support that that you need to get things up and running at your school. Thanks so much for having me on, Dan. It's been a pleasure, and I'm happy to do it anytime you want me on the show. You just let me know, I'll be there.
Well, I'm going to hold you to that, and we're going to have this this interview up in on the archives at theopiumden.net sometime this afternoon, and I'm sure we'll get some good downloads. So again, Chris, thanks a lot, my friend.
All right, thank you very much. You have a great day.
You too. Bye now.
Bye bye.
Well, there you have it. An hour and 5 minutes with Chris Crane, the executive director of Students for Sensible Drug Policy, known on the street as SSDP. So we hope you enjoyed it, and thank you for coming inside the Opium Den. My name is Daniel Williams. Thank you.